This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Welcome everyone to the Wheeler Centre tonight. Before we start, I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge that we're meeting today on the traditional lands of the Kulin Nation, and that we pay our respects to elders past and present, and to the elders of any other communities that might be here today as well. My name is Lena Van Deventer, and I'm a writer, game developer and teacher. I've taught interactive storytelling at Swinburne and RMIT universities, and this year I published my first book. Yay! thank you for cheering that. Game Changers, From Minecraft to Misogyny, The Fight for the Future of Video Games, with my dear friend Dan Golding, exploring some historical and cultural contexts surrounding one of my passions, which is video games. And I have a suspicion I might not be the only one in the room. Tonight we have a wonderful group of practitioners here to have a conversation with us tonight, to talk about games writing and its intersections with more traditional screenwriting, which is a fascinating line that is becoming more and more irrelevant as the days go on. They're being blurred at a rapid rate, with screenwriting courses around the country beginning to explore such concepts as immersion, agency, choice, and these things are normally notions confined to game design degrees, so it's really exciting to see some mingling between the disciplines happening, so we're going to be talking about that tonight. We're starting to see it really, really evidently in things like the Melbourne International Film Festival this year having a VR category, and virtual reality is starting to be that conduit between getting screenwriters to start thinking about games and how putting someone in the art will change the art. And something is shifting, and I can't wait to talk to these panellists tonight about that in more detail. On to them now. James Cockier is a writer and game developer from Melbourne, who's written for League of Geeks and is a contributor at the hilarious Cracked.com. Please welcome him. Brooke Maggs is a freelance writer, narrative designer and producer, working with the Voxel Agents on The Gardens Between, an adventure puzzle game with no text or speech. She's also the narrative designer on Earthlight, a virtual reality game about the wonders and perils of space for Opaque Media Group. Brooke has taught game studies, user experience design and cultural studies at a tertiary level for over 7 years now. Please join me in welcoming her.
Got some fans. Look at that.
And she's brought a posse. Trent Custers is a writer and game designer and founded game development collective League of Geeks that I mentioned previously with James, responsible for the digital role-playing strategy board game and international success story, Armello.
I wrote that part.
I thought so. he's the board chair of the Free Play Independent Games Festival, Australia's longest-running independent games festival, and a lecturer at the Victorian College of the Arts. Please join me in welcoming him. So, even though screenwriting courses are remaining as popular as ever, very few students are writing traditional screenplays as we would have known them in the past. Instead, they're writing for the web, for interactive shorts, and very often for video games as well. So the core elements of storytelling are still there between both. Games demand tightly constructed worlds, rich with theme, character, plot, dialogue, you know, very similar things are required in both, and a consideration for implication as well. And for gamers whose actions influence the storylines and outcomes of these worlds, connection to story is absolutely key. So the expectation for most modern games is that the narrative will be appropriately complex in some places, and they're backed up sometimes by literally thousands of pages of lore as well. So there is a lot of writing involved in the game's world. Tonight, let's look at the way writers can seize on the creative and collaborative potential of games, and explore the ways in which the line between excuse me, very ill, between writer and games writer may be blurring to the point of obscurity, maybe. But first, we need to understand that distinction between the two a little bit better, I think. So my first question to the panel would be, what's the hardest thing about switching from a linear writing mindset to an interactive one when writing for games? Why is it something that screenwriters don't necessarily automatically know how to do? I guess to distill that, what's so special about interactive writing that makes it hard?
Well, I started out as a traditional writer, I suppose you would say. I wrote short stories and working on a novel at the moment. And it was because of one of my short stories that I was recommended to write for The Gardens Between. But bridging that gap has been interesting, going from a, you know, I guess, non-interactive medium to an interactive medium, where you first have to ask the player, you know, opens up your story or your game and says, okay, so what do I do? Instead of, you know, starts absorbing a story. So they very much have actions that need to be rationalised by the story as well. So the story provides a context for what the player is doing, which means that I learn to work really collaboratively with the rest of my team to be able to do that properly. You know, whereas when I was writing my short stories, I didn't need to collaborate with anyone. I could sort of just do that however I wanted to. But writing for games meant that I had to think about how what I wrote impacted on everyone else in the team, you know, technically, artistically, how the story would sit, especially with The Gardens Between, because there's no text or speech. We tell the story with the environment, with the colour palettes, with the gameplay. So I very much, my job really is to communicate the story to the team and then help them, sit with them and communicate it to the player. So I went from, you know, I would write a little scene for how the game would start, and then one of the key questions the team would ask me is, good, but how do we show that? I was like, yes. So I would sit there with a notepad. And I ended up writing a lot of things, instead started writing dot points, and then would sit with a sketch pad between myself and the artist. My terrible stick figures were not great, but we would still figure out a way to show visually what was going on and then how the gameplay and interactivity worked over the top.
Great. James, you were more recently a student than the rest of us on this stage, so it might be a bit more fresh in your mind that first time you actually sat down and tried to make a story that had more than one path. Mm. Did you cry? Was there fire? Was there blood? how was that? Can you remember that day that it clicked?
Vaguely. I think the biggest challenge, I think, was trying to figure out the very basics of writing for a medium that's still very new and has a lot of things that aren't fixed within it. People kind of inherently understand a book, but you can totally get a situation with games where you could put someone in front of a computer and they would have no idea what's going on and wouldn't understand how to interact with the product, where you don't really have a situation where you put someone in front of a book and they're sort of scratching at the spine going, look, I just don't get it. So I think that learning basic things like how to write a branching script, how to be able to plot storylines without having the fallback of like a Hollywood script convention or standard novel plans and three-act structure plans, was probably the most difficult part. It took quite a while to click and is still clicking, and it's still so open that I think that I will continue to attempt to click for quite a while.
Trent, are you still clicking? Is it an ongoing process?
Yeah, it is an ongoing process because every game is different. So every game has a whole new set of mechanics that you need to teach a player, or might be targeting a completely different audience, or, you know, it could be on a whole different platform. Or now if you're writing for VR, it's like a whole different way to interface with the medium entirely. So, yeah, definitely. And, of course, the subject matter changes. I think one thing is that, you know, a lot of, like, if you pick up a book, right, you pick it up and you open the first page and you start reading. And obviously there are some exceptions to that, but every game can be vastly different in how you interact with it. The genre doesn't just change what type of story, it actually changes the actions that you're going to be doing. But it potentially to like maybe boil down a bit of like what's been said is that that real random element is the player. Like that, at the end of the day, that's the big point of difference. And it's like, okay, yeah, of course, that's obvious. But so I wrote the curriculum for the Writing for Games module in VCA screenwriting degree. And the first thing that I did was, or in the course when I was teaching it, is I just tell the students, I get them up and running in Twine, which is a little interactive text program, I guess you would say. And I just say, write a game. Write like an interactive branching story. Just make it a real shitty story. I don't care if it's good or bad. Just write it. And the whole exercise is not to see if they're good writers. I mean, it's a folio selected course. They're in their second year now. These kids or adults in the course know how to write. So it's just about getting them to trip over the first few steps. And those first few steps are watching people play your game and go, oh, that's not what I wanted them to do. Or watching them balloon out into all these different threads. And there are all these first sort of, I guess, issues that you come across, all these little nooks and crannies and problems that you'd never expected when you first start writing for interactive media, that just throwing yourself in the deep end can get you through. And I think that's the big thing, is being aware of the player and the player's state, and being able to relinquish control, and instead of being like, I am God, I'm the author, say, you are the actor and both the director, how can we help write a story together?
Yeah, that's exactly how I felt too the first time. Letting go was very hard for me because I liked that strict authored experience. But sometimes a game's only as good as its player, unfortunately. And that's really confronting sometimes if you want to have a specific game that you want to make. Sort of leading on from that, what can screenwriters and games writers learn from each other? Is this the start of a beautiful friendship? You know, if what could they teach each other if they sat down and said, if you want to have a go at making what I make, here's what you should know, and the other way around? Or what could a games writer tell a screenwriter that might surprise them or interest them?
Well, I think screenwriters could teach a thing or two to games writers about how to write good dialogue.
Yeah.
there's a fantastic talk from GDC around 2011, which screenwriter David Freeman talks about advanced dialogue techniques. And it's one of the best talks that's been given at a games conference ever. And it's a lot of that stuff that, you know, screenwriters, I think good ones, take for granted, is just, you know, that the rhythms of natural speech are completely counterintuitive and all these types of things. And I think there are other things like TV shows, long form screen media, like, you know, your TV serials and stuff. There's a lot of that that you could transfer over to games, and I don't think we see enough of that. And I'm sure there's a lot that games writing could teach to, you know, screenwriters. I would never make a case of what that would be, but yeah, there's definitely more sharing to be had, and I think we're seeing more of that as we go on.
I think, you know, screenwriters are very amazingly structured in the way that they have to work, which I think helps. But that might also be something that the games writer doesn't always have the privilege of, depending what project that they're working on. I think both writers understand, because they're both collaborative mediums, that the story bends and changes according to production and according to what happens. But especially with a games writer, you know, you kind of craft the story understanding that it could dramatically change next week. and that's okay, you know. But I used a traditional story structure for The Gardens Between, and it actually works quite well because we can sort of pad out how many levels or less levels we can have in each section of the game. But not all games, you know, necessarily lend to that either. So, you know, I think both screenwriters and games writers have the same story tools, or understand, you know, plot and characterization and dialogue to a certain extent, but how they execute those can be quite different, I think.
It's actually, you kind of just touched on something that I think games writers are incredibly good at, which is modular writing.
Yes.
So within a game, you're looking to embody or sort of create an experience for someone to dive into and, well, experience, right? And you do that through a number of scenarios, and you may come along and just have someone chop it, or it may not work, it may not playtest well, or whatever the reason is, or players may be playing completely different characters. I mean, I had to write a game once, a Scooby-Doo game, and where you could hot swap in any of Mystery Inc. at any given time. And so I had to write 5 lines of dialogue for every single line in the game. Mm. And that's the sort of thing that I think that approach to storytelling where it's completely modular and the end goal is the player experience, I think is something that could be incredibly useful to people who write in a linear format.
And people who write in a linear format might be surprised to know that there are different states of the game that you need to write for, so different characters. So for Earthlight, we have to predict what the player might do wrong in order to write the dialogue for that. So if they're doing a puzzle and they drop a drill, we need to have dialogue for, hey, pick up the drill. We need to have dialogue for, get back on track. We need to have dialogue for... So we need to sort of work with the game designers to predict what might happen to build a context, but also help the player to get back on track and help that be believable as well, you know, within the character's personality to give that direction to get back on track.
Yeah, it's still got to flow. It's still got to work in context.
Yeah, exactly. So you find yourself writing in a spreadsheet rather than, you know, writing with a script, you know, writing program. So, yeah, that's interesting too.
And the heartbreaking thing that I think a lot of screenwriters would come across when they start to make games is that not all of your genius will ever be witnessed. There will be some parts of your work that probably won't ever get read, and that's very different for a screenwriter who has a very authored... you know, view of almost sitting you there with your eyes peeled open, watching, you know, you will watch what I'm about to tell you. You have to let go of a bit of that. Did you feel that, James, when you were studying in a screenwriting course and doing a games elective, did you feel like studying games made you a better screenwriter?
Absolutely. I thank you.
Trent was his teacher.
Yeah, obviously I did the module that Trent taught, and I also did the VCA screenwriting course. One thing that I found really interesting is that, and this might be, I believe it's a trend through a lot of modern screenwriting courses and a lot of the kind of screenwriting industry at the minute, is it's very open-ended and people are encouraging screenwriters to look at podcasts, film, TV series. They're encouraging people to think in terms of serials and also in terms of like a Netflix binge. So there's all these different ways of watching media. You're not always there with your eyes kind of Ludovico machined open, as you described. And games writers thinking in a modular way and being able to respond to people absorbing their media in radically different senses is one of the things that I think will be particularly useful to screenwriters who want to work within diverse fields of media like podcasts, TV, web series. I think... games writing teaches a flexibility that will be really useful for anyone who wants to work within that field.
Very interesting, yeah.
Jamie and I, primarily Jamie, wrote 250,000 lines of text for iMallow. And you, through any given game, you would probably encounter like 1% of that in one playthrough. So that gives you, that gives you an idea of... sort of how much you can put down and how much can be experienced in just one playthrough.
But that also means that players can, you know, have their own completely different experiences with the same game.
Yep. And that's why we do it, right?
Exactly. And so there's also the story that the player tells themselves about the game that they play, which is not necessarily something that happens with film either. You know, you say, oh, and then I went over here and I did this and I did that and I went and did you end up going down that way? No, I didn't, but, you know, and then that opens up a bit of a meta story that sits on top. But, yeah, there's the every player will have a slightly different experience with the same game, which is interesting.
Well, it's almost like we're making story machines, right? And we're just writing into Excel. Like, I know writers that have actually reached the bottom of Excel. Like, that's how much text you can actually
write. Really? Is there a bottom?
Yeah, there's a bottom.
Okay.
They might have patched it since, but yeah, the writers on Saints Row found the bottom of Excel.
Oh, so I want to send them flowers or something. That's awful.
So we just, you know, we just put words and like just bits, really abstract bits completely out of order into these string tables, and it goes into this weird machine that creates stories for players. And it's such a beautiful, beautiful thing. And as you know, this is the weird thing when people ask about writing in games or writing for games, is that some of the best stories told in games don't even have text. You know, they're just stories created, like The Gardens Between.
Oh,
good time for a plug. when the players are just able to create their own story through the actions that they do, and if you can have some text there, or if you can have some visuals there, or some audio, or whatever tools it is that we pull on, and you know, we were talking before about how do you communicate this story? Like, that's really the role of narrative design, right? Which is something that you don't have in a lot of linear mediums. It's something kind of unique to games, where there is a role or a responsibility directly responsible for how does the player get this piece of story now? How are we communicating that to them? And sometimes you have to create entire mechanics or features or
asset lists.
Yeah.
Yeah. What I do for Earthlight 2 is if our character has a desk, what is the minimum amount of assets I could have on that desk to convey her personality? Because, of course, the more assets is more time and money. So I have my minimum assets, so a coffee cup, an engagement ring, and, I don't know, a photo of the family. And then my plus is, like, some other personal effects that we can convey. So as the narrative designer, they're the other things that you write that, of course, never make it into the game but that are crucial to your role. So you then I have conversations with art and say, can I have these things, please? And then talk to tech about a dialogue system that will rate, you know, how characters feel about you depending on if you succeed or not. And if we have that complicated dialogue system, I have to track it in a spreadsheet and rewrite. If this character is angry at you -1, then they respond like this. If they're angry at you -2, they respond to you like this. And then that's the lines of dialogue that I write. So
it's really interesting, isn't it? Like those technical... I remember I wrote on a script when I first started out writing games almost 10 years ago, and I wrote on a script for a cutscene in a game, and the crowd cheers, and I gave it to our animation director, and he's like, are you paying for the crowd? I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, we can't just call up extras. We've got to make all these models. I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
And then I remember on another game, I was told that we didn't have budget for one of the characters. We had to cut an NPC, a non-player controlled character, just a character that you meet in the world that had dialogue and everything. And I was like, oh, okay, well, I've already written all the story. And they were like, well, it's not going to make it in the game. So I had to go back and rewrite this dialogue. I had to get really clever with it. So I said, what if you could just give me, like, you know, American-style basement doors? It just did that. Can you give me that? And they were like, yeah, we can do that. So I just wrote that the character was hiding in the basement. And so you just talked to them through basement doors.
Nice. And, you know, that's so super creative.
All these really interesting ways that we work with deadlines and, you know, trying to achieve this story with these incredible technical constraints of the medium.
Yep.
We'd call that being agile.
We do. Very agile.
Yes.
Very
agile.
Yeah, I mean, I did a similar things with Gardens Between when I first came on. I was like, oh... And Frent slips off the side of the mountain and Arena jumps and grabs him and pulls him back up. And I'm like showing it. And Henrik, our creative director, was like, we can lift an arm once. And I'm like, okay, so we'll put that arm raising at the end of the game as like a woo or something. And then the rest we can see what we can do.
I think the closest thing screenwriters might be able to empathise with in terms of that kind of scenario would be wanting really grand establishing shots.
Yeah.
Right.
And,
but and
as a helicopter cranes over the Grand Canyon.
Well, I guess now we've got drones, so, yeah, you know, it's much cheaper. Mm. But it doesn't necessarily change the whole world.
No.
Speaking of VR, we did mention that very briefly just now, especially with the recent popularization of it, and it's getting a bit cheaper, so it's getting a lot more coverage and a lot more action with people. We're seeing that line again blurring between game and film on a much larger scale, and the VR symposium at MIF comes to mind, and also a really large amount of VR experiences at Tribeca Film Festival as well. In New York. This may be a bit of a chicken and an egg question, so forgive me, but do you think a lot of these projects are filmmakers exploring interactivity or game makers telling particularly filmic stories?
I think the first one.
Yeah, I agree. Because I think a lot of the exploration, I mean, that I heard at the film festival was talking about, you know, because VR is 360, you know, you can look around and, you know, the filmmakers were talking about the fact that they needed to write outside of the frame and think about what's happening outside of the frame. And to which I was thinking, well, yes, you know, that 3D world that we create in games. And so I think, yes, exploring interactivity was perhaps the emphasis of that conversation that I noticed. Yeah.
It's almost like it's a weird thing to say, but it's almost like a passive interactivity as well. You know, like you're looking at, you're sort of passively observing or interacting with the environment.
I heard a term that a lot of VR filmmakers are now calling the audience as the observer when referring to VR film, which is a pretty apt term, I think.
Oh, the observer.
Yes.
So creepy, right?
It is creepy. It is. Yeah, it is. It's like, who's your friend? That's the observer.
That's the observer.
Oh. Yeah.
Mm. There's a Pixar plot in that where they refer to the observer. Oh, the observer.
The observer. What's going on?
It's strange. I think that generally anyone that I know in games tinkering around with games is kind of just making games, but in the way that they sort of always have now with a whole lot more interactivity and immersion, I guess you would say, to use the dirty word. So, and I think a lot of people, and it's only natural, right? You're a filmmaker, you get this new piece of tech and you're like, whoa, think of all the ways I can make film now with this tech. And you're a game maker, you get the piece of tech, you're like, whoa, think of all the ways I can make games. Yeah. I think that's only, it's a natural extension of both roles.
Mm-hmm. You're working on VR at the moment.
Yeah. I was just going to say, it's interesting because, you know, a lot of things that come up for us when we're writing for VR, myself and the scriptwriter Claire, we think about, can we move the player? So at the moment, with games, obviously, you can move your characters. With VR, the one we're designing for is a seated experience, so the player's not actually moving. So we need to put them into positions where there's something interesting for them to look at. So I was saying the desk before is you're naturally seated at a desk, so that environment works. And then in VR, you can pick things up and look at them and turn them around and look all around your environment. So we have to think about locations where that's interesting and where there's enough story that can be told with that stationary I guess way of interacting and observing, so yeah, that's interesting. It's a different kind of writing too, so you have to,
I think there's something really interesting with how game developers approach technical problems or the impacts that that new technical constraints have on the medium and on their craft and their ability to express themselves within their chosen medium, because it's what we've been working with forever. I mean, it used to be like clockwork. Every 6 years you'd get a new console and, hey, guess what? This one has motion controls that kind of don't work, and this one has a Kinect that watches you in the lounge room all the time. And there's always, or this is a phone and it's touch controls, so have fun, you know, like that's what games has been for 60 years almost. Mm. And on now it's changing at such a rapid rate that there aren't console generation cycles. It's just new tech is coming in all the time, new ways to interact with the medium. And it's phenomenal. It's half the reason why a lot of us are here, because the challenge is incredible. But I think what that creates is a bunch of people who are very good at getting their hands on new tech or a new way to interact with something and solving those problems very, very fast.
Mm. Yeah, definitely.
That's an excellent point. Would you like to tell us any more about your VR game just before we move on out of our little VR section?
Well, something that was just jumping to mind was that, you know, writing for games, I think, is very technical, you know, because you do have to, it totally helps if you understand those technical limitations. So as a part of this project, I'm trying to make sure and still make sure that I'm talking to the people who are making it and, you know, watch them and talk to tech and talk to art and say, what are your considerations for this? And what's game design's goal for this? How are you making this interaction interesting for the player? And what are the goals for the game? So the game is to create, you know, the most realistic, immersive, I guess, astronaut training experience. So we're thinking of ways to help that through with the narrative and, you know, setting a context for that medium. But in terms of VR-specific things, it's dealing with those technical limitations of the player can't move, but that still needs to be interesting. We need to put them in story-rich environments, but it also means that we can plant props. It's almost like it's stage design, set design and things like that. It's sort of, a lot of comparison is drawn between VR and theatre as well, which is I think maybe a more helpful comparison when it comes to the things that you need to consider when writing for it. So yeah, they were my thoughts.
So the what I'm picking up tonight, and I've been musing on for quite a while, and I'm sure a lot of other people in this room are too, that's why you're here, is how many disciplines are going to be involved in making stories told in a VR sort of way. Mm. We've got theatre makers, we've got game makers, we've got filmmakers and screenwriters, and imagine who else we could like invite to the party and make amazing things. But more on that a little bit later. So awards play a really big part in the screenwriting industry in the world, and to a lesser extent the games world. For example, our awards are not televised and they are not as glamorous. but would there be value in, say, an interactive or a VR category at the Academy Awards, would you think? Like, we have games winning BAFTAs. That's a thing that does happen. But would there be any benefit to makers or the cultural conversation around games if we held up our finest in this way? And what impact could that have here locally, do you think?
That's such a curveball question.
Yeah, it is. It's tricky. There are a number of things that jump to mind.
I think anyone doing cool stuff with VR is good for games. Like, if I can speak to my interests, like, you know,
you may.
I want to say that my life doesn't revolve around games, but everything that I do has something to do with games. It's bloody depressing. No, it's wonderful. But you know, my interests in this is if. VR, okay, put it this way. I want to work in VR. I love VR. The first time I put on a Vive and a huge whale flew past me, I was like, done. I'm sold. This is the Matrix. Jack me in. I want to know Kung Fu.
Yep.
But there is no financial case right now for me to take our studio of 12 people and put them to work for a year to 2 years or 3 years on the scope of game that we want to make for VR. There's no financial case for it whatsoever. Zero. And that ship has sailed. Maybe there was at some point when Oculus was handing out that sweet Facebook money, but that's not around anymore. So if the film industry wants to come along and put VR in the headlights and have a film category and get a Vive in every household, then go for it, pals. I'm down, because I'll get to make my VR game.
They have permission now. Yeah. Thank you, the Academy. What do you think, James?
I went to a Kaleidoscope, which was a VR festival a couple of months ago, and... exactly what Trent was saying. It was a very difficult situation because there was limited tech available, and you had this huge station for Samsung Gear VR, which is just used as a phone and like a kind of plastic headset that you can put around. And everyone kind of went through that in about 5 minutes, and then there were just these queues out the door for the two Vives and two Oculuses that they had set up. So no one really got to experience those. And one thing that I noticed, which I wanted to ask you about, Brooke, actually, is I noticed a lot of the VR films that were coming out really used, although they would be really interesting, they were often very focused forward. Mm. So you'd be put in a 3D environment and you'd look behind you once and you'd see something moderately cool, and then you wouldn't be required to look behind you. Some of them were even in cinemas and just looking at a screen, which is cool, but it didn't feel like it was using the tech to its full capacity.
Yeah, I mean, I've had some experiences where that's been the case. I mean, I saw The Turning Forest at the film festival, and that was amazing. Like, I really loved that. Like, that was my VR experience that made me go, yep, totally on board with this. Like, I want one at home. Yeah, because that was beautiful, just being able to be within that fairy tale-esque environment, and there were things going on encouraging you to look around. But then again, VR experiences need to, by nature at the moment, be quite small, because it gets super uncomfortable to have that mask on, looking around, you know, hurting your neck all the time, turning and twisting.
Motion sickness is a thing.
No, but it was the perfect length, that one. But that is a limitation of the medium at the moment, what I perceive anyway, because, you know, sort of somewhere around 15 to 20 minutes, and that's sort of how we're trying to write Earthlight, in these 15 to 20 minute blocks of time that allow players to take a rest too, you know, factoring in that rest time and downtime. where they don't feel like they're going to miss out on anything if they take the mask off and have a rest. Mm-hmm. But by the same token, we also want them to feel like they need to come back and keep going. In terms of awards and things like that, I think it's... I don't know how to place them. I think awards are interesting in and of themselves. But, I mean, if... just some way to bring games and VR storytelling in general to more people would be great. Just for the visibility would be wonderful. Mm. But I don't know if awards are the best way to do that, but I definitely think that, you know, games are a cultural medium, like they're so important, and, yeah, showing some light on them would be good.
To go back to Jamie's question about there being a focal point in VR, I think it's just, like, we have that in games as well. Like, we've been working in 3D worlds for, you know, forever in games, pretty much. But we're still trying to drive the player towards something. We're trying to get their attention, you know, like, put the spotlight on the car over there so they know to go to the car because that's where the items are, whatever it may be. And it's like, when you have a story, whether it be interactive or linear, there are going to be plot points, right? And they're called points for a reason, because everything sort of comes together there in that. And you need the person to experience that or pass through that plot point in particular. So we're constantly trying to funnel people through. It's one of the greatest challenges of open world design in video games. It's like, how do we get them to funnel through these plot points?
You said open world.
I know, I'm sorry. I also said immersion, so I put two on the scoreboard.
Oh, that's two strikes.
But I think this is something where VR will find its feet in other ways. One of my favorite, and I think one of the most accomplished VR experiences that you can find out there, and it's amazing because it's been around pretty much since the birth of this latest iteration of VR, is Daniel Ernst's dioramas. He's a developer, a VR developer based in the Netherlands, and he makes these incredible dioramas where you're just sitting in a room, because, you know, it's a seated experience, like you say. You're sitting in a room and you're just looking around the room, and around the room are these amazing, incredible, like hundreds of them, points of interest. And it's just this experience. And actually, when he does installations, there's one where you put the VR headset on and you're sitting atop a stack of chairs, like 100 meters in the air, and it's sort of wobbling a bit and the breeze is going past you, and there's all, like, there's things set up around you, like coffee tables and everything. But in the installation, you actually have to climb up a bunch of stacked chairs to sit on it. And I think it's experiences like these where people will actually take the room scale stuff that the Vive is doing and create these fully rounded experiences where we get really, really talented at finding ways to funnel the player through those plot points or having the player explore and find their own ways through it. But I think having things focused is just one of those first early tripping points.
That you work out. Yeah,
great point. my sincere apologies. It must be awful to listen to, but I can't help it. So, speaking of awards and sort of the legitimacy that may come with them or may not, that's probably a discussion for another evening. What barriers do game makers face in terms of, and this might be my third strike by saying this word, for finding funding for projects that screenwriters may not. So there's a number of funding bodies that will not talk to games makers, who will gladly talk to screen artists. Can anything be done to apply pressure to large arts funding bodies to get them to talk about games? And if this line is blurring between screenwriters and games makers, are we going to scare them off? Are we going to, you know, is our presence going to be negative to these screenwriters in these projects? We can talk about collaboration between the disciplines all we like, and even, you know, posit a new kind of maker that might be coming out of this. But if funding bodies like Screen Australia refuse anything with the word game in it, I'm worried about how far we're actually going to get to go with this, and how we proceed with this new romance. What do you think is going to happen to the funding landscape if we do play with screenwriters more?
It's really interesting. I think in the short term, it's like, you know, it would produce... It's kind of like, hey, look, we're playing well together. Can we get our dessert later? Is that cool?
Yeah.
Thanks, you know, thanks, yeah. Mom. Thanks, Dad. I think there's definitely an element of that right now. But I also think the bullet train that is the cultural legitimacy of video games is stopping all stations, and it left the first station a long time ago. Mm. And I think that, you know, a particularly large funding body that recently cut video games. There are a lot of fantastic people who work there and are champions of the medium, and it really just comes from the old guard who understand nothing about video games just coming and putting a red pen through a figure of money that they were like, games. And so as more people who have grown up with video games being the aesthetic form of their generation, that's it's so ubiquitous since they were in primary school, they've been walking around with games in their pocket, we will begin to see those avenues open up. I mean, you go to, like, you interface with students all the time. I'm the same. And when you see the way that they talk about video games, there's this really strange thing in the video game industry at large or the medium at large where we have this inferiority complex or we have this legitimacy complex and we're constantly trying to prove ourselves. But if you talk to students today, they don't feel that. They don't feel that at all because they've grown up in not just interacting with video games, but them being a major part of their life forever in a mainstream way as well, not just like, oh, our mum got an Amiga and we used to code on it at home or something like that. It's like, no, they literally have been playing games every day of their life forever. And I think when the old guard goes and those people just start to bleed into positions around the place that are actually signing the checks on these funding and sitting on the boards, it's just not going to be a question. I mean, the financial argument's been there forever and the cultural one is already here. It's just people realising it.
Can we have our revolution, please? Brooke, do you have anything to say about the funding future of this sort of collaborative work?
I don't profess to know much about, as much as Trent perhaps knows about the different funding bodies around. I know that we are, or our project has been supported by Film Victoria, and they do a spectacular job of supporting the games industry.
They're awesome.
Yes.
Thank you.
And, you know, there are funding rounds coming out all the time from them, which is spectacular. And, yes, if there were more... Maybe there is like lots of opportunity to, you know, have other funding bodies present these the ways of funding. So, for example, can encourage those collaborations between Screen and Games. So, you know, we will fund a narrative project with Screen people attached and with Games people attached. See what you can make. That would be super lovely. I mean, I'm very optimistic. So, but I think that, you know, I think funding bodies have the opportunity to drive that cultural shift and those opportunities between industries as well by offering up those things. So, you know, here's some money you want to do some VR, get some film people, grab some games people. Obviously, it's not that simple, but they can certainly, you know, that can certainly help. Yeah, and I think Trent's right in terms of just the natural cultural shift between attitudes for games as well. You know, it's not really that uncommon for me to find people around my age who are shy about saying they play games still. You know, some of them are, some of them aren't. But and then admitting you make games, that's pretty great too. And, you know, people are always... People even who don't know much about games are fascinated by that and they ask me a lot about what that's like and, you know, how do you do it and what does that mean? And I think, you know, I firmly believe that there's a game out there for everyone.
I do too. That's a big part of the course that I run at VCA is like I come in because they're not all of them are into games. You know, they might just be screenwriters and they might actually hate games. And I've had a couple of those instances. But through the course of 10 weeks and showing them all of the very different experiences that people can have with video games, that's...
Pretty astounding.
Yeah, it's pretty astounding. Like you show, you know, there was a young girl in your class who hated video games, thought they were a joke. But when you show her that, you know, it's not just ninja shooting. Parkour assassins, you know, that there's a game out there about, you know, a 13-year-old girl struggling with her sexual identity while her bigger sister's away on a gap year, then things start to resonate, you know.
I think that's a beautiful note to end on because we've run out of time. I'd like to open up to some audience questions now. We've got two roving microphones. This event's being recorded, so if you could wait until you get the microphone to start asking your question, that would be much appreciated. And if you could make sure that your question is a question, that would also be very, very much appreciated as well. Yes.
First of all, thank you. That was a really good panel. And seeing so many people here who care about the same thing makes me feel less lonely. It's really
games
nice.
Games bring people together.
But the actual question is, there are people out there who are writing software and artificial intelligence to replace a large part of what you guys do in terms of writing dialogue and plot points and so on.
This panel's over, by the way. That's enough, okay.
Please and, what? And this is exciting. But are there any examples you can point to of ones that you're excited about or that you think might be the future of generative storytelling?
Yeah. Go, Jamie.
Jump in with something? Cool, because I'm really interested in procedural generation.
Yeah, I'm super interested in this as well.
I think that there's definitely a lot of amazing stuff that's being done with procedural story generation. One of the ones I love to talk about is Dwarf Fortress, which has an amazing narrative to it. But I also think that there's always going to be a space for writers developing amazing stories. And one of the best examples I think of when I'm considering something that completely occurred because of computerized error is stories that arise from glitches. So about 10 years ago yesterday, there was a really huge World of Warcraft glitch. And I might get the name of it wrong, but the Corrupted Blood glitch. Do any of you guys know about this?
I remember that.
So a giant glitch happened in World of Warcraft.
There was a lot of nodding.
Wow. Yeah, everyone's like, oh, yeah.
Like, uh-huh. Dark times.
Yeah, they were all there. Yeah, they were raiding when it happened.
Exactly. So basically, long story short, an attack would infect a player and then they could carry it into cities and kill thousands of people with it. And people have written like books on that story, right?
Really?
So that was entirely accidental, but the lore that it spawns is huge, and the way people interact with it. And it goes back into what we were talking about earlier about the player being the ultimate kind of creator of this, an architect and director of the story.
Mm. That's what I was going to say as well, is that games are story machines. So, you know, if it means that me being a creative director in games is turning to my robot pal and going, make a love story, and I'm going, cool, bro, done, then, like, that's cool. But I'm, like, I'm very, you know, and I very much believe that I'm totally in the camp of the Terminator theory, so I believe it's all swell until that day comes. And that anyone here who has a job is going to be replaced by, will be at a point where you can be replaced. I don't think that there's anything untouched and I'm no expert in AI, so I'm just rambling up here about it. But I totally feel that even you look at the early days of AI that we're sort of in now, like in its infancy as sort of like, these crazy experiments that are going on and what's happening and what is being created, I think that it's totally feasible that, machines will be able to write amazing works of art.
Yeah. Oh, I'm feeling so threatened.
And it would be helpful.
I know, it's terrifying.
In a way,
making me sweat.
You wouldn't have to figure out all that branching dialogue yourself.
I'm also totally leaning into it as a coping mechanism, so we'll see.
I do not approve. Not one bit. I like eating and living in a house very much.
Great question.
there was an AI that won second place in a Japanese short story contest
recently. Wow.
Prose writing, which is
pretty
cool.
There you go.
Next step is monkeys and Shakespeare, I guess, on the typewriters. We have got another question down there. Yeah.
Hi, thank you so much for the panel so far. We've heard a lot about the collaboration between screenwriters and game designers, but I was wondering whether you, I have a bias, I'm a theatre maker. I was wondering why we don't see much collaboration between other forms of artistic endeavours and theatre makers as well. I mean, we've just had Audio Jam, clearly that's aimed at audio engineers. So have any of you thought about working with theatre makers or, I mean, you talked about them in regards to VR, but I was wondering whether there was any further negotiation or collaboration, and if not, why not?
I think that it's sort of hard to answer a question as to like why is this craft not collaborating with this craft, or can we do that more? Mm. And I think the answer is like, yeah, come at me, like, you know, bring it. Tell me how we can work together and what cool stuff we can do.
That is such a Trent answer, by the way. That is such a Trent answer.
Yeah, like I really would love someone with theatre experience to just shoot me an email and say, hey, I love what you're doing at League of Geeks. I've got this really cool idea. How can we do it? And is that you, Dave? Did you ask the question? Yeah, boy. All right. So we've collaborated, man. You know, like I guess you could call even like just me ranting at you for an hour over coffee about like your cool new project, like I guess that's a form of collaboration, right? Right, Dave?
I think we may have just seen the birth of something right
here. Yeah.
I think that also it's actually been a pantomime kind of is a game, really. Like, yeah. You know, where's the villain? Behind you, that kind of old, in games and theatre, it sort of goes back into kind of what we consider play, I think.
So here's the big reveal. I did pantomime for like 10 years in my family business. So the greatest collab of all.
Yeah. Full circle.
We collaborated with a set designer to do the Gardens Between at the ACMI. Matteo has, you know, made us a beautiful setup
And
it was absolutely gorgeous. And the way that she interpreted the game, you know, we went to the Melbourne Theatre Company and got a whole bunch of props and set it up, and it was awesome. Like, and that essentially was theatre in a way where we created this space where, or Matteo did for the most part. I can't profess to have anything to do with that, but it was beautiful, and people could sit in gardens while playing the Gardens Between. That was that was a really interesting way to collaborate with that, you know, maybe shaping it around the player experience where they're sitting physically and what they're experiencing in the game would be super cool. I'd love to see more than like that.
Also, you can like YouTubers, live playthroughs, Harmon Quest, Critical Role, all of these people playing games, showing them theatrically. Exactly. I mean, I think that there's a. I mean, if you take sort of the, you know, people live streaming and commentating on kind of games and showing their kind of D&D playthroughs as theatre, which I mean, especially something like Critical Role, totally is. There, a lot of them are theatre practitioners. I mean, that's a really popular evidence of collaboration already.
I think as well, it's like a lot of it isn't about collaborating together, like working together for extended periods of time on a large or major project. Like collaboration can be, like I was saying, Dave, you know, just sitting down for a coffee
chatting
and shit, you know. Yeah, just, you know, like sharing your trade craft, or it can be, like you said, working with Matteo and like getting like this like single little project, this lived experience that happens along the game's journey. I mean, I treat, whenever we work with press, like I treat that almost as a collaboration. Like, you know, I pitch them like, what about this story? You know, I'm trying to work and understand how they're, what their readers want, what will help them write about my game. And it's a weird way to look at it, but I think those mini collaborations along the way, like,
Very helpful. Try
and think, how do I make a huge game? You know, it's like, no, how can I work with game developers to make my theatre better? Or how is there a way that I can just, you know, have some input on a game or do something cool with a game developer?
There has been interactive theatre around for quite some time as well, to varying levels of success. We've had certain stories in the UK, I can't remember what it was called, but there was something where the audience votes on where the story is going to go via controllers that were in front of their chairs. And there's also the work of Tassos Stevens, who does a lot of interactive theatre work as well. And he sometimes gets the help of Twitter and that sort of thing while he's on stage. Yep. Next question, though. Sorry.
Thanks for being here tonight. I'm kind of new to this whole collaboration between writers and gamers. So my question is, do you guys have any suggestions for how screenwriters could be working professionals as game writers? Are there any ways to go about that, or is it all kind of luck and, I don't know, meeting the right people? Thank you.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Those two things have a big part to do with it, for sure, at the end there, luck and knowing the right people. But I would also say that games are so incredibly accessible right now. They're more so than they ever have been, and it's increasing exponentially every day. And so if you want to write for games, just start making games. Making games with the types of stories and the types of experiences that you want to make. Doesn't matter if you can't code, you can use Twine. Doesn't matter if, you know, if you want to learn how to code but you want to just dip your toes in, use something like Construct or Stencil. Or, you know, even if you want to go the whole hog, like I gave Jamie the crazy advice to do, and learn Unity, you know, and a bit of C# programming, you can do it. And I say this to the students that I teach who want to get into games, is just making games is the best way to prove that you know what you're talking about. Because I'll tell you right now, there's no shortage of writers who've never made a game but want to write for games. And as Brooke sort of touched on earlier, the technical limitations of writing for a game, or the technical challenges and the technical requirements, or knowledge requirements, I guess you would say, to write successfully for a game are immense. And the faster you can go through those steps, like I was talking about with the Twine game and making those first mistakes yourself, the faster and better positioned you'll be to walk into a job in games.
One thing that also occurs to me, I mean, the way that I found myself in games was writing and luck and knowing people, but also I was writing for a really long time before that and had developed a body of work in a different medium, which also helped speak to my ability as a writer. And I still, you know, write character profiles, write synopses, write, you know, scripts and things like that. So having those basic skills in the craft of writing absolutely helps. And writing, you know, within a body of work, within however you like to tell story, will definitely be helpful for games as well. But learning the technical and understanding the technical limitations by making a game yourself, by definitely recommend checking out Twine. It's really accessible and easy to create an interactive story where you hyperlink between different parts, where you can have a branching story. You say if you can go left or go right, if you want to make that basic choice, so you can add many different choices. Variables and you quickly and see how complicated it can get.
Oh yeah,
that's for free as well at twinery.org.
Yep.
For Mac and PC as well, and I don't work for them.
I think it's kind of a lot of the same advice as you'd give someone wanting to get into any creative pursuit in terms of like who you meet is important and luck is important, but also work hard and just learn the medium from kind of back to front.
Like if you play games too.
Yeah. If you didn't know any films and didn't know how a camera worked before you wrote for screen, it'd be like, go learn how cameras work, go watch a bunch of films. Like for games, you know, go learn how games work and play a bunch of games and then become creative steps, I guess.
And I think this is a big mistake. I'll be very quick. This is a big mistake that I think a lot of writers trying to get into games is that they can be very accomplished writers outside of video games.
Right.
And they come to the medium with the assumption of like, hey, I'm a writer, I will help, and game story sucks, so, you know, here I am. Like, I'm ready. Let's go.
I have arrived.
Oh, wait a minute. Why are you changing my story? Yeah. Stop.
And so there's been a bunch of us that have been working with the Australian Writers Guild to set up the interactive committee and doing a bunch of advisory there. And that's been one of the biggest things that we've had to impart is that, like, yeah, it totally is a completely different medium that has a huge amount of knowledge required to work within it. And it's not just this like thing that you can just waltz into and expect to just ace walking off a typical writing gig, I imagine.
And every game is different to write for.
Yes.
Just add that.
100%. Yeah. We've got time for one more.
This is my question for the teachers. Whenever you encounter students who are so-called hardcore gamers, what kinds of techniques do you use to encourage them to step away from the typical storytelling that most mainstream games that they've encountered with tell? Like, how do you make them see that there's more to storytelling than just shooting or the usual things that you see from the mainstream?
I put it on the reading list.
Yeah.
I put the games that I think they should be exposed to on the reading list, and all of our literature is revolved around not Shooty Bang, Shooty Bang's Revenge, or Shooty Bang 2.
What are some of the games on your reading list?
Galatea by Emily Short is an amazing... is an amazing exercise in dialogue, I think. And there's a couple of other things that we explore.
Yeah, there's a few that if you get someone who's like, I'm going to write the next Uncharted, you know, you're like, okay, well, sit down and let's play Gone Home, Papers, Please, Dysphoria, and just rattle off a bunch of games and have them like walk through those or sit there. And actually, I got told after my first year teaching at VCA, they were like, all right, look, the course is, you know, you've got great feedback, but a little less playing games. We're playing a lot of games. And it's basically because the best way to teach people who already know how to write, or to show people how diverse Storytelling can be in video games, and the breadth of the toolbox, like the range of the toolbox that we have and its ability, is to just put them through a range of vastly different experiences, from the small and bespoke to the huge, like general. Even, you know, I sit them through a couple of sessions of The Last of Us or Uncharted, and really when you see the possibilities within the storytelling medium, it's pretty hard to keep eager young minds constrained after that.
Yep. Yeah, good answer. Yeah, you can't be a Michelin star chef and only eat Easy Mac, you know? You've got to eat some other stuff. And
but your Easy Mac is going to be real good.
It'd be tasty. It'd be real tasty. We've run out of time, unfortunately. But thank you for your company tonight in this discussion and for putting up with all that coughing. It's my name's Lena Van Deventer, and it's been an absolute pleasure to host this evening with you tonight. Thank you to the Wheeler Centre and the Victorian College of the Arts for partnering together and putting this on tonight. And last but definitely not least, please join me in thanking our panellists, James Cockier, Brooke Maggs and Trent Custers. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.